What is the Trilateral Commission? By whom was it formed and for what purposes? What is technocracy? Why should you care to know about either of these things? Stay tuned for my interview with Patrick Wood, where you'll find out why you must be informed about the end game being implemented globally right now.
Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
Well, the time has come, Navarre said, to talk of other things. Of shoes and chips and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
It's called the American Dream, because you have to be asleep to believe it.
Welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Patrick M. Wood is the editor of the August Forecast and the August Review. The August Forecast provides a succinct look forward to analyze trends relating to markets, economics, politics, and finance. The August Review is an historical review of global elitism, its players and policies. As an author and lecturer, Patrick frequently speaks on his research findings related to the Trilateral Commission, technocracy, transhumanism, and scientism, and how these are transforming economics, politics, and religion globally. Here to speak with us today about his latest book, Technocracy Rising, The Trojan Horse of Global Transformation, is Patrick Wood. Welcome to the Soaring Eagle Radio Show, Pat.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here. I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you taking the time. I know you're very, very busy. Pat, your new book, Technocracy Rising, has created quite a stir among people that pay attention to world events. And by way of introduction to our conversation today, let me read from the back cover of the book. And this is a quote. The dark horse of the new world order is not communism, socialism, or fascism. It is technocracy. Started in the 1930s and reintroduced by the Trilateral Commission in 1973 as the New International Economic Order, it is now known by names like sustainable development and the green economy. Technocracy is a movement started in the 1930s by engineers, scientists, and technicians that proposed the replacement of capitalism with an energy-based economy. Originally envisioned for North America only, it is now being applied on a global basis. The authors Aldous Huxley and George Orwell believe that technocracy would result in a scientific dictatorship as reflected in their books, Brave New World and 1984, end quote. Pat, that small quotation says it all. We are submerged in an age where the globally minded elitists are rapidly bringing into focus their long-held vision of a temporal utopia. And I applaud you for the courage to stand on the hilltop and shout to a sleeping world, hey, look at what's going on right under your noses. I've read your book, and it is a fact-filled, well-documented research piece that reads like a who's who of the movers and shakers of economic and political movements today. Technocracy as a word and as a concept has been around for decades, yet it remains surprisingly ambiguous to a majority of Americans. How did you become aware of technocracy originally?
It was hard. I thought I knew something about American history, and turned out I didn't know nearly as much as I thought. It was a very humbling experience. But I ran across a book or a paper somewhere along the way that talked about technocracy, that there was actually a historical movement, and that sparked my interest. And I went to take a look at it. I found a few articles online, mostly in academia-type circles, and I found a couple of books through Amazon that were printed way back when and available, and I bought a couple, started reading up on it. And I found out that there was a major historical movement in America, mostly in America, but Canada was very popular there too. It was called Technocracy Incorporated, and prior to its incorporation, it was just called the Technocracy Movement. And they had at one time, Mike, over 500,000 card-carrying members of this organization all over the country. And especially in the West, it was huge in Canada as well, especially in British Columbia. And these people were zealots. I mean, they were really zealots about their proposed utopia, if you will. And what they proposed was creating an energy-based economy, based literally based on energy, instead of supply and demand and price-based economics. And this was in the heat of the Depression, a horribly depressing time for Americans, for sure, all over the world. But here especially, there's food lines, there's unemployment, there was hunger, very depressing time. And a lot of people believed that capitalism had died and that it just was no longer, is never going to come back to life again. And the technocrats, the scientists and engineers that were associated with this originally, they kind of rose up and said, well, you know, capitalism is dying because technology has been advancing. And so what we need to do is you need to let us scientists and engineers run everything. And we need to have a new economic system that's based on efficiency, that's based on resource management, that's based on social engineering. And we'll use our scientific method to run society, and everything will just be hunky-dory.
Now, for the average American citizen, Pat, these were new concepts, weren't they?
They were totally new, totally radical, totally different.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to realize, too, back in that day, if you kind of, you know, role-play, put yourself back in their shoes, the big thing in that day was to go to a coffee shop and argue over the latest radical philosophy. That's what they did. They passed their time that way. Why, there was Marxism, there was Darwinism, there was fascism and communism. The Bolshevik Revolution took place in 1918. Why, you know, all of these things, you know, caught people's attention. And there was fascism, you know, building in Europe. And so people were arguing, you know, constantly discussing the latest and greatest radical new idea that would reform the world and make everything good for everybody forevermore. And technocracy was one of those groups that really got traction over some of the other ones in our country. And, you know, people, you know, tended to want to outdo each other. Well, I'll tell you what, the technocrats, that the scientists and engineers that were doing this originally at Columbia University were hot stuff. And they were received as hot stuff. Because they were, of course, professors and engineers at Columbia University. That's kind of redundant thinking, isn't it?
Yeah.
But,
Yeah.
So that's where, you know, that's the cauldron that it came out of. And Americans kind of rejected it after 20 years of it. They said, nah, we're not going to go that way. It's a good thing they did, too, because, you know, I always laugh at this. I said, shoot, it's a good thing we didn't get technocracy. All we got was a new deal.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, and knowing what I know now about technocracy, I shudder to think where we would be if it hadn't been shut down then. Looking at where it is now and some of the things we're going to discuss in this show, if it would have had all of those intervening years to continue to formulate and to, we'd be in serious trouble right now. But anyway, so you mentioned Columbia University. So they kind of gave them some, if you would call it this, some official recognition by allowing them to formulate a program there. Is that what happened?
That's exactly right. Many of the original people were actually teaching professors at Columbia at the time. The movement had a start really in the 1920s where groups were starting to meet, that is science engineers, some economists were starting to meet and talk about things related to technocracy. But it really didn't gain any kind of notoriety until it got official sponsorship at Columbia University, and then all of a sudden it exploded. And there was lots of notoriety. But unfortunately for them, one of the co-founders of the group, a man by the name of Howard Scott, turned out to be a fraud. He basically lied to everybody about his credentials. He didn't even have an engineering degree. And he basically kind of foisted that off on Columbia, that he was like this big, you know, brain, you know, monkey muck engineer. And then they found out, hey, this guy's talking the talk, but he doesn't even have a degree. And what the heck does he know? And so they realized that they had been played by this guy. And the head of Columbia at the time, Nicholas Murray Butler, was an egomaniac himself. And he didn't like the idea that he'd been played. So he literally dropkicked the whole technocracy movement out of Columbia and said, you know, get out of here, you bums. So the professors that were all into it basically shut their mouths and went back to their departments. they never renounced technocracy, but they said, holy mackerel, we're not sticking our neck out again. And they shut up and just went about their careers. And Howard Scott and the other co-founder of Technocracy, Inc., went off and incorporated in New York, started a membership organization. And they went on to accumulate a membership all across America and Canada as well. And the co-founder, by the way, was a man by the name of M. King Hubbard, who some people will recognize as the man in 1954, 20 years later, who founded or who started or proposed the so-called peak oil theory. Back then it was called Hubbard's Peak. But peak oil theory has been a key component of the radical eco-movement today, the resource movement today. They point back to that. They kind of look at Hubbard as one of their founding fathers, if you will. Yes. So, anyway, that's kind of where it got us start. And it was a little bit nefarious. They lost their credibility when they got kicked out of Columbia. But they had enough notoriety around the country where they were able to sign up almost 500,000 people as card-carrying, you know, dues-paying members.
Yes. Wow. Yeah. Well, you mentioned in your book, Pat, and you've already touched on several of the political movements and philosophical movements of the era. But you mentioned in your book some of the influencers, some of the intellectual fathers, if you will, philosophical fathers of the movement, names that have generally been forgotten if they were ever known by the masses. But people like Henri Saint-Simon and Auguste Comte. Some of their theories and writings play a prominent role in technocracy as we see it today.
Absolutely so. And Saint-Simon is widely hailed as the father of technocracy, by the way. This is not just my opinion. There's several people have written about this. And the technocracy movement itself holds him up in high esteem. One of the things he wrote back in a journal way back when he was alive, he died in 1825. He wrote, this was concerning the general topic of scientism. He wrote, "A scientist, my dear friends, is a man who foresees. It is because science provides the means to predict that it is useful, and the scientists are superior to all other men." Close quote.
Wow. Superior to all other men.
So the religious aspect of scientism and this whole package was defined way back in, you know, around at least 1800. There was a religious component that is still escapes men today. It escapes analysis today. But there is a religious component to this, and Henri Saint-Simon, Saint-Simon was at the bottom of it from the get-go. And the New School for Social Research, which is in New York, which is now called New School, that was a school that was founded back in the early 1900s, And the New School was a progressive social research school that the professors that were too radical for Columbia University, They ended up at New School. That's basically the way it played out. It was really a pretty, you know, it was really a far-reaching type organization. But they wrote, the New School wrote about Henry St. Simon. And what they said, and this is still in their website documentation, they said, Henry de Saint Simon is renowned as the founder of Saint Simon, of the Saint Simonian movement, a type of semi-mystical Christian scientific socialism that pervaded the 19th century. This is what they wrote, right? Saint Simon envisioned the reorganization of society with an elite of philosophers, engineers, and scientists leading a peaceful process of industrialization tamed by their rational Christian humanism. Wow. His advocacy of a new Christianity, which he wrote a big paper on, about 100 pages, his advocacy of a new Christianity, a secular humanist religion to replace the defunct traditional religions, was to have scientists as priests. This priestly task was actually taken up by two of his followers, Barthélemy Prosper Enfantin and Saint Amand Bazard, who infected the whole movement with their bizarre mysticism and ritual. This is where technocracy found its roots, if you will. It's hugely religious, let me put it that way.
Yeah, and you mentioned that they viewed scientists, engineers as priests. So is it fair to say that the scientific methodology would be their doctrine?
Absolutely. Very much. Well, let's say that would be the means to transmit their doctrine, even if it isn't their doctrine. A case in point would be the prince of climate change these days, who is still Al Gore, you know, the poster child. And Al Gore goes to the mountain to carefully listen to what science says about climate change. He comes down the mountain and informs the rest of us peons down here what the oracle said. Well, the oracle said that temperature is going to rise 2 degrees, that the oceans are going to, all the ice is going to melt, the oceans are going to rise, and I think we're all going to die, probably next year. And you see, if you don't agree with him at that point, he had a speech about three months ago. He had a speech, and he stated anybody who doesn't agree with climate change is a denier, D-E-N-I-A-R, E-R, denier. So he called everybody a denier that doesn't agree with him, and he said that deniers deserve to be punished. He used that word, punished.
Wow.
Now, I'm glad he doesn't have the means to punish me.
Right.
But you understand it's just for lack of means, not...
Yes, that's, that's right.
But if he ever gets it, he probably will. But you see, this has all the markings of a cult.
It does. Yes.
You see, the cult it never allows any dissenting opinion, ever.
Correct. Correct.
If you don't believe the way the cult leader believes, why, you are a heretic and deserve to be burned at the stake.
So for our listeners, just to be sure that that they're understanding this clearly, Pat, technocracy is a system of measures and technology that's aimed at controlling the economies of the world through the governments of the world, and it has a religious component to it. Is that an accurate representation?
That's very good. That's very good.
Yeah. So how are they going to go about bringing these wholesale changes? I mean, the globe, you know, the Earth has billions and billions of people, hundreds of governments, a lot of different ideas about how to rule, but yet they want to bring all this together. How are they going to do that?
Well, conveniently for them, they have used the United Nations to be the contagion to bring this doctrine to the whole world. And they've used climate change and sustainable development and Agenda 21 and related programs to impress upon the entire world their doctrine of sustainable development. which is essentially technocracy. And they call it a green economy. There's plenty, and they've written plenty about it. It is, as I said, it is a replacement economic system. And I wrote about that in my book and surmised that with great care that this is where it's headed, that capitalism one day is going to be replaced by technocracy if these people have their way. Well, 2 months after I wrote my book, it, this figures, right, when I put it to press, stuff always comes out 2 months after you, you know. Oh, shoot, man. Why did I wait 2 months? I could have put this in, you know. I had to give that up. But after about 3 months, I said, I'm not going there anymore. But listen, the head of climate change at the United Nations, who is seriously a really big mucky muck, her name is Christiana Figueres. She's the executive secretary of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. That means she's numero uno. Well, I should say numera una, I guess. But anyway, she's the head person on climate change at the UN. She had a press release on February 3rd, which is just 2 months after I released my book. And she said, and I quote, "This is the first time in the history of mankind that we are setting ourselves the task of intentionally, within a defined period of time, to change the economic development model that has been reigning for at least 150 years since the Industrial Revolution." Close quote.
Wow.
Now, this is a sea change, Mike.
Yes, yeah.
This is a total sea change. People can't hardly get their head around this. Why would the United Nations want to change the economic development model from capitalism and free enterprise to anything else? And the anything else, by the way, is their green economy, which is pure unadulterated technocracy from the 1930s. You can just trust me on that for a bit till we can develop it. But here is a blatant, flat-out statement. This is what it's all about, folks. Capitalism is going to go. They claim that they have, they claim that they're doing it intentionally. It's not by accident. Okay. And they claim that they have a time frame that they're going to – now, I don't know how that's going to work out exactly, but they claim they have a time frame.
Yeah.
So this is not some idle speculation on her part where she's voicing an opinion, you know, like, well, I think capitalism ought to be scuttled, you know.
Right.
That's not the way she's stating it all. She's stating this as a, making a declarative statement.
Yes.
We are going to replace capitalism. Period.
Yes. The operative word there is we.
That's right.
There's already been numerous conversations and strategy meetings. Does this go back, Pat, to the Rio conference in 92? Does this have anything to do? I mean, were the seeds sown there?
Absolutely. They were sown earlier than that, Mike, but the Rio conference that produced the Agenda 21 document, which was the agenda for the 21st century, by the way, this is the document that popularized the term sustainable development. This is where that came from. The whole thinking came from the Agenda 21 document. Before that, the word had been used, the phrase had been used, but it really didn't have any widespread use at all, except maybe within the bowels of the United Nations. And if we go back a little further from Rio, we run across a UN convention that was convened by the UN to study, you know, future generations and what was going to happen in the future. And this big commission, it's a big mucky-muck commission with a bunch of global leaders and stuff part of it, became known as the Brundtland Commission. That was because the head of it was a lady from Europe by the name of Gro Brundtland. And the Brundtland Commission worked from 82 to 87 and produced a book called Our Common Future that was primarily architected by Gro Brundtland. And Our Common Future was later hailed by the United Nations as being the driving force behind Agenda 21 dogma and the 1992 Rio conference, okay? So that's what the United Nations says about it. They look backwards from 1992 and say, it was the Brundtland Commission, it was Gro Brundtland, it was Our Common Future. That's where the stake was planted in the ground. for the 92 conference. And so what's interesting to point out at this point is that Groh Brundtland was a member of this organization, the Trilateral Commission. She was from Europe, but the Trilateral Commission had members from Europe, North America, and Japan at the time. And she was one of those from Europe that was high up in the hierarchy of the global mucky-mucks, and she was actually a member of the Trilateral Commission. And this gives a very clear sign on where the doctrines of Agenda 21, sustainable development, technocracy, et cetera, came from in the modern context. Now, the United Nations could have hired, they could have appointed, 10,000 other people to run that commission. But they appointed Groh Brundtland to do it, and she impressed her views into the document Our Common Future that later just, exploded at Rio in 1992. So this wasn't just a doctrine that just popped up somewhere. Oh, yeah, we just kind of thought this up last Sunday. We were talking over lunch. No. Right. It was set in stone. It was choreographed, if you
yes.
will.
Well, this might be a good time to ask this question then, Pat. Why, every place that we look, do we see a Trilateral Commission member?
I'm not paranoid. They really are after me.
Yeah.
Well, you're
it's an unavoidable conclusion.
Anywhere there has been something substantive where it relates to global economics, you see members of the Trilateral Commission. It's just amazing. People would have to read the book to discover all the interlocks and stuff where these people show up. They have dominated the executive branch, since at least Jimmy Carter in 1976. Both Carter and Mondale were members of the Trilateral Commission. George Bush was a member of the Trilateral Commission. Bill Clinton and Al Gore both were members. Dick Cheney was a member. The only thing we can say about Obama is that he's not a member, but every person around him that's important to him is a member of the Trilateral Commission. So they have him surrounded as well.
So both members from both parties
and
other parties are members of the Trilateral Commission. That in itself should tell people, listen, we need to get past this mantra that one party is for this particular demographic or ethnicity, because really that's not the case at all, is it?
It hasn't been traditionally. It's completely spanned political parties. They've kept their argument way high. And good proof of that. When they captured the executive branch, and it wasn't about Democrats coming in and taking over the White House. It was about the Trilateral Commission coming in and establishing hegemony over the trade mechanism that was possessed by the United States executive branch. That's what they were after.
That's what they were after.
The proof of that, looking back, is so clear to me. Example, there have been 12 appointed U.S. trade representatives since 1976. Only 12. Out of those 12, 9 have been members of the Trilateral Commission.
Wow.
Now, these are the people that negotiate these crazy trade treaties. We're talking NAFTA and CAFTA, and some people say SHAFTA also.
Right, yes.
But now we have the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. That's coming right behind TPP. These are sovereignty-killing treaties and stuff. If nobody already knows that, they should. But guess who the current U.S. trade representative is negotiating all these things in top-secret environment, by the way, is Michael Froman. He's been Obama's U.S. trade representative since 2013. He's a lead negotiator on TPP. He's the one, by the way, keeping this agreement under lock and key. At the bottom of the Senate building,
yes,
in the basement, where nobody can go in to see it except that you check in. You have to leave your cell phone outside.
Well, yeah, that's right.
Your pens and notepads outside. You can't even take notes. You can go in and look at the document, but you can't touch it.
Yes. Well, you know, we talk about the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, and we, although we shouldn't, because this is a serious matter, we joke about it all the time that, well, you got to pass it to read it and know what's going on with it. In the case of these negotiations, these trade pacts that our trade representative, that's Michael Froman, I think you said?
Yes, he's a member of the Trilateral Commission.
Yeah, yeah. So in this instance, he's negotiating these treaties, and it doesn't matter if our Senate reads them or not, because they don't have the power to do anything with them other than vote them up or down. Is that correct?
Well, that's what the so-called trade promotion authority is all about. If the vote on Friday or sometime in the next few days approves the trade promotion authority legislation, then what that means is the president can bring the TPP to the agreement to the table, and it has to be approved by the Senate with a simple up or down vote. With a simple majority, no amendments are allowed, limited debate time is allowed, and basically there's no time for public review. So it's giving up the normal Senate rules for approving trade treaties. There's no reason for it, my estimation, but what it does, effectively, it gives them a sledgehammer, to drive home the trade agreement with only a simple majority of a vote.
And that's what's in the fast track?
That's what fast track is all about. Yeah. It's fast track is not needed. There's no constitutional mandate that we should do anything like fast track whatsoever. And it's interesting. The history of fast track is really interesting. If you got it, we'll just take a second. I'll tell you. It was first put into law back in 1974 after Richard Nixon resigned. You'll remember who assumed the presidency.
Yeah, Gerald Ford.
It was Gerald Ford, and he was unelected president, but that's the way the law reads. President gets out, the vice president steps up. Well, the vice president gets to appoint his own vice president for the remainder of the term. Kind of a curious thing. But he gets to appoint one, and guess who he appointed, except it was Lawrence Rockefeller, the brother of David Rockefeller, right?
Yes.
So what does that make Lawrence Rockefeller as vice president? Well, lo and behold, it makes him the president of the Senate.
Yes.
And guess where the first Trade Promotion Authority Act was passed? It was in the Senate. And this TPA, that they were smart enough to put a 6-year sunset on it, by the way, so it expired. There's been contentious fights every time it's tried to been renewed, every time a president tries to get it. But the TPA legislation has only been invoked when these trilateral types want to get a particular trade agreement passed that's important to their agenda.
Yes.
Such was the case with NAFTA. NAFTA was brought into being through the Trade Promotion Authority Act. That's how CAFTA was brought into being. And there's been a couple of others as well. But on the other hand, there have been hundreds of trade agreements and treaties that the Senate has negotiated under regular constitutional terms over the same period of time. There's been hundreds of them. And it's just business as usual. They have to come in. They have floor debate. They have discussions. They add amendments. They do other stuff to it. They tear it apart. Whatever they did to it, they still have to pass it with a 2/3 vote. That's the requirement in the Constitution.
Yes.
So there's been, so the TPA has only been used for a very specialized type of trade agreement, and the TPP is one of those.
Well, we should be very wary of that as Americans. I was reading someplace recently the direct results of NAFTA was that we lost 50,000 manufacturing facilities in the United States to foreign countries.
Yes.
Now, I didn't say 50,000 jobs, 50,000 manufacturing facilities.
That's right.
Left America's shores for other nations. And that should tell you what these secret treaties are all about.
That's what it is. That's what it's all about. And you have to, where a lot of these jobs went, of course, has been to China. I think there's a pretty good awareness of that, that China's been smoking us for a long time, you know, taking whole industries away in some cases. And you look back and to see who opened up China in the first place, this is astounding. Henry Kissinger made the first trip when he was Secretary of State under Richard Nixon. It was considered at the time to be patently illegal what he did. Some people were calling for his immediate arrest when they came back and found out what he did, because China was a sworn enemy of America. And the Constitution says you can't go and negotiate with a sworn enemy without having approval from Congress.
Yes.
Well, he didn't go to Congress. He just went and bought a plane ticket. Well, actually, I think he flew out a private plane. So nobody knew what he did. Nobody had a clue he went to China until he came back and said, "Hey guys, guess where I've been?" And he was the guy that first started the soften relations, and then the whole process was finished with Zbigniew Brzezinski when he was National Security Advisor for Jimmy Carter. And Brzezinski, of course, was a co-founder of the Trilateral Commission with David Rockefeller in 1973. It was Brzezinski who single-handedly thawed the relations and brought China into global trade. They did it. This is Brzezinski's baby. History is factually documents that. Brzezinski's pictures are all, his picture is almost every one of the trade deals that you go back in the 70s and look at. There's Brzezinski in the background. He's there in all of them. And it was him that did it. And so, you know, you say, well, okay, so who benefited from this? Well, you know, we found out that before Congress even authorized trade to be done with China at all, any American, it was illegal for Americans to do trade with China, period. Before it was made legal, Bechtel Engineering, the largest engineering company in the world, whose chairman was also happened to be a member of the Trilateral Commission, of course. Bechtel Engineering had carried out some 18 major infrastructure projects in China before our own Congress even made it legal to do business in China.
Man, oh man.
So you know where the money's going, right? You follow the money. These are the people that rush over there to build up China, to give them infrastructure, to give them facilities and factories. They invested money. They invested engineering skills. They made China what it is today, literally. And China turns around and sucks our own manufacturing base to pieces. They sucked it overseas.
Yeah. And that was all a masterstroke, the first salvo, if you will, of technocracy. They created the belief that this brave new world that we live in, to borrow Huxley, requires a global economy. And so the way to go about that is to do an end run around sovereign governments and create these trade pacts that will just open border. Of course, can you speak to the real result, though, Pat, of what happens in these things? I mentioned NAFTA and the manufacturing jobs that left. This isn't about free trade.
No. No, that's just an, I don't know, it's not an oxymoron, but that's just a clever term that they thought of.
Yeah, that's just the cover.
Yeah, who could argue against free trade? It's like sustainable development. Who could argue against, you know, I mean, just, you know, it's just a slick term. It's a marketing term. But just the opposite is what's happening. It hasn't been free. It's been rigged from the get-go, and it's been rigged for them. And the rest of us have been frozen out. This is so easily documentable now, looking back over 40 years of economic statistics, is so easily seen that these people set up a system. You know, it's like gaming the casino, right? If you could get a hold of the computers in the back of the casino, why, just think what you could do.
That's right.
You know, the busloads of people coming to, you know, pull a slot machine arm. They weren't really tourists. They were your employees from the next state over. And you send them in you know, go to slot machine 42, 36, you know, whatever, and you just sit there and pull a thing, and you're going to take a bucket load of money back home with you when you leave. We guarantee it. Because we're in the back room where the computers are, and we can manipulate those odds any way we want.
Yeah, that's right.
That's what they did. That's what they did. They plundered it. I use the word plunder. They literally plundered our country.
So so that's the economy. Let's talk about what they're going to replace it with. What's their vision there? And I know it has to do with a so-called green economy, and energy exchanges. And so let's go there for a while. I believe if you go to the United Nations Environmental Program website, it gives us a pretty bold statement, doesn't it?
It does. And the green economy intends to, what they say, decouple resource usage with economic growth.
What does that mean exactly?
That's oxymoron.
Thank you.
True. You cannot decouple economic growth from resource use. Every businessman knows this. You have to have inputs to your business in order to have a business. And hopefully you can get more inputs as time goes on if your business is popular and people want your products. You hope you can get more of those resources to grow your business. That's how you grow your business.
Right.
If you don't have the resources there to build more of whatever it is you sell, well, of course, you can't. Your business won't grow. It's just going to mark time, but at least be thankful you're in business, I guess. But the way the United Nations and technocracy looks at it is if you make your economic decisions based on resource usage, then basically the people who control the resources tell you what you can and can't make and what you can't do, you see, because they throttle the use of resources. This is what sustainable development is all about. It's controlling the resource usage, limiting resource usage, so that we selfish people out here don't overconsume, and that the selfish businesses who help us overconsume stop helping us overconsume, and they will be told what they can and cannot make that we might consume. This is the essence and heartbeat of sustainable development. They don't want you to own private property. They don't want you to be responsible for anything other than what they tell you to do. This is technocracy, an energy-based economic system. Example. If energy was currency and I received a monthly allocation, like kind of like food stamps, of my energy allotment, let's say for a given month, that I had to spend on goods and services. If I wanted to buy a shirt, I have a shirt on, you probably do too, you could go down to the store and the shirt that's on the shelf that you like could theoretically be priced in terms of the energy it took to make it. Now, you had the farmer. He had a tractor. He had to put diesel in his tractor to plow his field. He had to harvest the cotton. The cotton got sent over on a truck to Egypt. Egypt had to spin it and make it into thread. Then it got sent over to another country, maybe Sri Lanka or somewhere, to be spun into material to be put into a shirt. And then maybe it went to somewhere else, to China or somewhere, on a ship to be sewed into a shirt. It was shipped back to America, sent to the Gap. The Gap sent it out on a truck to the store. You went down to the mall and went to the Gap and said, I like that shirt. And theoretically, there's an energy value on how much energy it took to make that shirt and get it to where it's hanging in your store in your local community. Conceptually, I know you can grab that.
Yep. Yep.
So you go down to the store and you have an allocation, let's say, of 1,000 energy credits or whatever they would call them, 1,000 ergs. I don't know. And the price of your shirt is 200 ergs. And so you shell out 200 bills or whatever and say, okay, I'll buy that shirt. And to a technocrat, a balanced transaction just took place. You got energy in your pocket based on the energy credits that they decided you should have in a given month. And you could allocate those yourself to goods and services that where energy was required to make them. To them, that's a balanced transaction. To you and I, that's insanity.
Yes, that's right.
To a technocrat, on paper, it makes perfect sense. And this is what the green economy is all about. This is what sustainable development is all about. There is no provision for private property, by the way. The early technocrats said this. They said private property is an outworn concept. Nobody should be needing to own anything. We will provide what they need and what, you know, what people will be happy with. We'll decide that. And people are just free to live their lives. Well, Agenda 21 came along and said exactly the same thing. Private property is on the chopping block in Agenda 21. Totally. They don't want us to own anything. They want all the resources of the world put into a global trust run by trustees. And unelected trustees, of course. Yeah. And if people will go to them and petition a lease of resources or maybe, you know, the use of some resources, you know, kind of like the offshore gas wells are done down in the Gulf of Mexico where you have to go to the government and buy a lease, you know, to put down a well. Well, they will decide who gets the rights and who don't. Mike, you know, if you wanted to drill a well on that basis and you went and you had a hot idea where some oil and gas was and you went to them and said, hey, I know I'm only a pastor, but I've got an idea. I could do pretty good in oil drilling. And I'd like to drill a well out there on property X4Z. And they'd look at you and say, who the heck are you? Mm-hmm. You know, but then right after you would come in somebody from BP or Shell and say, we want to invest, $2 billion in that oil field down there. And we want to lease some of the resources from you. They're, oh, sure. For you. Oh, yeah, man. You can have anything you want. Just pay us $1 billion.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's the game. Once the resources are locked up, you and I will never see it again as private property.
Right.
You know, forget ranches, forget owning cattle, forget manufacturing plants and stuff like that. You'll be asking someone else for permission to use whatever they have decided that you can't have.
You've just described essentially a dictatorship.
That's right. It's a scientific dictatorship. That's exactly right. It's important to see here in technocracy that it's a system of things that's putting the collar around our neck. Yes, you can define the economic system, but the system of things that's being put in place is designed to keep us corralled, if you will, into a certain behavior where you can't move left or right, up or down, sideways, whatever. They want to keep you in a channel that limits your choices and options. And I'll give you a good example. I'm sure you have a bank account like I do. Go down to your bank tomorrow and try and withdraw $400 to your ATM.
Yeah.
It'll say, I'm sorry, but the daily limit is $200.
Yeah.
And you're going to say you're going to speak to the inanimate machine and say, look, I've got $10,000 in my account. I want $400. And you say, sorry, you only get $200. Now, and they won't, you say, come back tomorrow and get another $200. No, I want it today. Well, you're flat out of luck. But that's an example of how you get corralled into limited choices. You just can't do it. And when you talk about, like, smart grid, for instance, collecting energy usage information on Americans and citizens all over the world now, where they're putting smart meters on the side of homes, guess what these smart meters are designed to do? They're designed to look at your consumption of energy to determine what you should and should not be able to do. So if along the way there's a heat wave and the energy company or the utility company is kind of running out of power, they're getting tight. Of course, they don't want to spend any money to build any more generation equipment. They have to balance the load. That's the big mantra. They have to balance the load. So what they do is they just reach in through your smart meter and they change the thermostat on your air conditioner. Or they shut off your washing machine so you can't use it in the middle of the day. Washing machines take a lot of power. Mm-hmm. Or et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you know, they can monitor and control from the outside now the energy inside people's homes and businesses. And they're doing this all over the country right now. And all over the world. This is designed as a control mechanism. Because if you can control energy, you can control everything.
Yeah, yeah. What I find also interesting, Pat, is hearing you describe these things as control mechanisms. I'm thinking about the number of items that are available for sale now, and they're being offered as the latest technological advance that's going to make your life so much easier and or so much safer. And I'm thinking specifically about Amazon and Google and some of these other companies that are selling products that can record conversations in your home, can keep surveillance upon your home, record data and send it off someplace. Are you aware of some of this stuff? Like Target, for example. I was just talking to Catherine Albrecht the other day, and she was mentioning that Target has announced this new initiative to implant RFID chips in all of their products. And I'm talking about not in the packaging, but in the actual product itself. For example, tennis shoes coming from China, they'll be manufactured there, and an RFID identifying chip will be placed in the molding of that shoe. You can't get it out without destroying the sole of your shoe. There's no good reason for a company like Target to do that. So what are they doing with this data that's going to track wherever you go, and who are they giving it to?
Ah, that's a good question. And Catherine is right up on these things, by the way, and she's absolutely precise on this. This is exactly what they're doing. And that means that if you're walking down the street someday, if anybody was smart enough to put an RFID reader out on the, say, on a light pole or something, and you walk by with those tennis shoes, and those tennis shoes are identified with you because you bought them with your credit card, they will be able to track your whereabouts just by noticing, oh, Spalding's chip just passed by the light pole down at 5th and L.
Now, what is he doing down here this time of day?
Yeah, what's he doing down there? I think we better call the pre-crime unit to see if, you know.
That's right. People watch these movies like Minority Report and some of these other things, and they say, man, that was very interesting, but no way. It's like, no, wait a minute. Yes, way. That can happen. It's going on right now.
It's happening right now. There was an article just today on this. The Department of Homeland Security is videotaping people in an attempt to determine pre-crime events. It's amazing. They're doing it today. Let me read you the first five requirements of technocracy that were documented in 1934 by M. King Hubbard, one of the co-founders of Technocracy, Inc. Got to hand it to engineers. They're good about documenting stuff. They're good about, you know, writing down their plans and proposals. These were the first five requirements out of seven that they gave in order to implement technocracy. This is a 350-page book that they wrote, but this was the centerpiece. These were the primary requirements that had to be met in order to achieve technocracy, and this is what they wrote. The first one, number one, and I quote, register on a continuous 24-hour-per-day basis the total net conversion of energy. Number two, quote, by means of the registration of energy converted and consumed, make possible a balanced load. Number three, quote, you see, there's smart grid, right? That's it. Smart grid's right there. Yes. Number three requirement, quote, provide a continuous inventory of all production and consumption. Continuous inventory of all production and consumption. That's right. RFID. They've got that nailed. Number four, quote, provide a specific registration of the type, kind, etc. of all goods and services, where produced and where used. Okay. Number five, I quote, this could have been written yesterday, right? Number five, quote, provide specific registration of the consumption of each individual plus a record and description of the individual.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, think NSA. Mm-hmm. Think DHS, think CIA, FBI, fusion centers, whatever you want, whatever pops in your mind. By the way, think about Obamacare. Do you think Obamacare is about your health?
Not at all.
Or is it about, or is it about your data?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, bingo. How about Common Core? Is Common Core about education? Clearly not.
No.
But, or is it about the data and the 400 data points that are being collected on every student that is subject to Common Core? It's about the data.
Yes, and one of the byproducts of Common Core is programming, right?
That's right.
They're programming
and
our children.
That's right. They're conditioning them for sure.
Yes.
But the idea behind this collection of data is that technocrats require a monitoring system within the system that they're trying to manage. If they use society as one big engineering project, they must have a monitoring system to give them feedback on what's happening in society.
Yes.
This is what all of this data collection is about. Mm-hmm. This is part and parcel of technocracy. That's where this comes from. It's not just because they want to spank us and make us mad. This is part and parcel of technocracy. Mm-hmm. And you know, all of this data collection stuff, Mike, that's come into just our view in the last couple of years, Edward Snowden did a lot to bring it to the surface of attention. All of these intelligence organizations have been answering to one single cabinet-level position called the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence. This was an office created by George Bush in 2005, and the office of DNI was given command responsibility for all 17 agencies, intelligence agencies in the United States, including the FBI, including the CIA, including the NSA, including Homeland Security, and all the rest of them. There's a bunch of them. The DNI set up they restructured the complete intelligence system in America to be what it is today. They're snooping down the data to want to know everything, including your DNA. And by the way, if you're on Obamacare and you go down and give blood, your DNA is now registered with the National Health Database. Yeah, they'll do a little pre-death analysis and figure out, you know, when your time is up, and then cut off your benefits a few months early.
There you go. That's
off point.
Yeah.
Here's the point of this. Bush appointed the first director of national intelligence who held that position for 2 years while he completely restructured and gave new marching orders to the intelligence community in America. He did it all. He really did. He has to this day, has line item budget control over every agency, every intelligence agency in our country, every one of them. He's able to write their mission statements, to modify their mission statements any way, shape, or form it pleases him. The DNI is literally the czar of intelligence in America. The first DNI that George Bush appointed, Bush was not a member of the Trial Adder Commission, by the way, but Dick Cheney was. He appointed John Negroponte to be the first DNI. Wow. John Negroponte, who had trouble in his own right. A lot of people didn't like him for what he did in South America. But John Negroponte was a member of the Trial Adder Commission.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Son of a gun.
Yeah. There it is again.
Can you imagine? now listen, here's why I say that. Did he architect the intelligence community to serve the people of our country? Or
clearly
even to serve our country?
Yeah, clearly
or,
not.
Or did he architect the intelligence community to serve the interests of the Trilateral Commission?
Yeah, clearly the latter.
Clearly the latter. They're the sponsor of technocracy on a global basis.
Yes. Yep, that's right.
Case closed.
Yeah. Yeah, so we've covered the end around of government. We've covered the economic remaking. How about religion, Pat? How are the technocrats massaging or reshaping religion to go along with this program?
Wow. The mainline religions of the world, as represented by the World Council of Churches, for instance, National Council of Churches, and various interfaith organizations, that typically doesn't include the Evangelical Church. I'm sure you would agree with that. There was a big convention last year in 2014 called the Interfaith Summit on Climate Change. And churches from all over the world flew in to church leaders to be at this thing. It was a big deal. It was maybe the second one of its kind, but it was a huge big deal. The World Council of Churches gave a press release after that, and this is what they wrote, quote, "There has never been such a large amount of religious environmental activity in one location in the history of the world. This week will mark a watershed in the history of religion. It will be the time that people remember as the time when the world's faiths declared themselves irrevocably as green faiths," close quote. That's all I'm going to say about organized religion. That includes the Catholic Church, the Pope. By the way, in this month, the Pope is going to issue a major encyclical on climate change. Now, an encyclical is not comparable to a papal bull, which turns it into actual church doctrine, you know, like I have heard from the Lord sort of thing. But an encyclical is something that is written up and distributed to all of the bishops in the world, who in turn are expected to take it to all of the priests and the parishes and stuff, spread it around. So this encyclical is going to drive a stake into the heart of the Catholic Church to plant green faith everywhere in the Catholic Church. And this has been done in other church organizations, the Episcopalians, the Presbyterians, the Church of Christ. I mean, all the big religions have fallen into this heresy now, this trap of green faith, where everything is based on sustainable development.
Yeah.
They dropped the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Yeah, and they're doing this in large part under the banner of the Earth Charter, which is really just a humanistic pseudo-religious treatise that plays on misplaced emotions more than anything else.
Well, it was, but let me tell you, the Earth Charter was part and parcel of the Rio Conference in 1992. It was called the First Earth Summit, and the Earth Charter was there. And the principal developer and author of the Earth Charter is none other than Stephen Rockefeller, who was a nephew of Nelson Rockefeller.
Yes. But Stephen's a theologian, though, right?
That's absolutely right.
Or
a theologian.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's been involved in the interfaith movement since it began many, many years ago. And he was the principal driver behind the Earth Charter, and his name is basically the only name associated with it. And, you know, you have to take this in perspective to the big picture. Why would Stephen Rockefeller be dedicated to this global interfaith movement, and if it wasn't somehow conjoined with his brother's plan for economic transformation throughout the world? The obvious answer is, of course they're connected. Duh.
Yes.
Stephen Rockefeller has been one of the board members of the Rockefeller Brothers Funds probably for the last 30 years. He's tight with his own family completely. He's completely in bed with them.
Yes.
So everything he's done has played along with the whole idea of bringing, you know, what Peter Drucker called his three-legged stool. That you had economics, politics, and society is basically based on religion. And these people know that without religion, they don't have a chance to promote or pull off their economic scam.
Right.
They've got to use religion to deceive people.
Yeah. Well, Pat, that's right. And all, I can't help but thinking about that passage in the scripture where Jesus said, you know, in the last days, the deception is going to be so deep and wide that if those days were not shortened, even the elect would be deceived. This is,
yes,
technocracy has, and I'll give it to the to the purveyors of it, those that are pushing it. They've been very, very wise in how they've approached this, But it is deception nonetheless, and it is a massive global deception. So that raises this question. What should we do? What is your perspective? Do you have any thoughts on what a Christian should do in response to this? What can they do, I guess, is the question.
Good question. I'll offer two things. Number one, if a Christian wants to develop a biblical worldview, we hear that term a lot these days. And I don't say that in the context of Kingdom Now theology, right? Forget that. But if a Christian wants to have a true biblical worldview, of course, you study your Bible on one hand. You have to know what the Word says in order to know anything outside of that. But you can't base your worldview on fantasy. If you believe lies and just, you know, dumb stuff about the world, inaccurate stuff about the world, I don't care how much Bible you know, you're not going to have an accurate worldview because half of it's based on just pure fantasy.
Yes.
So you've got to man up, in a sense, and study history and be willing to study a little bit about history to find out what does make this world tick and what really is going on. And then apply the Word of God to it to make some sense out of it. You really can, too, I have to say.
Yes.
But you're going to be frustrated trying to figure things out if you try to apply God's Word to some fantastical concept you have of how the world works. It's no wonder you're going to be confused and upset.
That's
going to fit.
And that's
one thing. That's one thing I'd offer. The other thing I'd offer to Christians is there needs to be a reignition of excitement on Bible prophecy. This has been lost in the last 20, 25 years for sure. Bible prophecy as a topic was hot back in the 60s and 70s, especially in the 70s. We've lost that zeal, and the reason, you know, a lot of the emergent church movement has actually told their people, don't study Bible prophecy. Because it's just confusing. God doesn't want us to know that stuff anyway, and just forget it. You know, don't bother. Just go out and organize your community to heal your world or something, you know. And so Christians have lost their passion for Bible prophecy. And yet the New Testament tells us, look, this is your blessed hope, folks. Discuss this stuff. Discuss this stuff. Talk about the signs of the times. And I'll tell you what, Jesus chastised them. Well, this was still before Pentecost, but he chastised them. He said, look, you sailors know how to read the sky, whether or not you're going to go fishing in the morning or not. You can read the sky, but you can't read the times. What, you know, it's like, well, is it that obvious? I suggest it is that obvious because Jesus made that connection. If you think it's easy to read the sky and read the weather, it's just as easy to read the times if you're willing to read them. You know, that the issue is willingness to read. We have signs all around us going on that are incredibly pertinent to Bible prophecy. If you want to talk about what's going to be the mark of the beast, for instance, in Revelation, if you want to see the system that the Antichrist is going to use to control the world, there's no better system than scientific dictatorship at the hands of technocracy. It is the perfect control system.
Yes.
For the Antichrist when he finally comes to power. You know, like what? Do people think he's somehow omnipresent, that he can be everywhere and thump you on the head, you know, anywhere in the world? He's a finite being. You know, he can't go everywhere and thump everybody. He needs a control system to have a scientific dictatorship that can simply be controlled by policy from one central location. I think this is the heartbeat. As we move towards that end time period, you know, how is Satan going to waste any of the 7-year period building infrastructure? Does anybody really believe that? He knows he's got 7 years. He knows his final battle with God is going to happen right on the horizon. He's only got 7 years. Do you think he's going to waste any time of that 7 years building infrastructure? I don't think so.
I don't think so.
If I were in his shoes, I'd be doing it right now. I'd be building infrastructure right now in anticipation of that time. I think it's getting close. And so I better get ready and I better get my ducks lined up in a row. I think this is what's going on right now, honestly.
Yeah.
I think that ought to excite Christians to no end.
It should. You're absolutely right. Yeah, and I agree with that perspective, Pat. We should be able to look and see and know that Christ's return is near. So what's next for you? What are you working on now? Any new projects coming up that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Wow, I've got so many, I don't know where to start. That's the way it is when you start getting exposed to this stuff. I would love to do research into the connection between technocracy and Islam. I know there's a huge connection. I just haven't quite put it together yet. I've got a couple of friends that are real experts in the field of Nazi socialism and, you know, going back to the roots of the Green Movement stuff, and Islam as well, that may well be able to give me some clues and direction. But no, there's another aspect. The nature of the religion behind technocracy hasn't been documented anywhere, anyhow. And in the book of Revelation, we find in Revelation 17, for instance, that there's a bonding of religion and the state. We see this as the whore, the woman on the beast. She's dressed in scarlet. She's riding on this beast that has seven heads and seven horns. And this mystery religion, mystery Babylon, if you will, is obviously bonded with the political state that represented by the Antichrist. And this is not a bonding of economics and the state like we have with fascism. This is a bonding of religion and to the state. And so we see there's a religious flavor, strong religious flavor to technocracy, transhumanism, and scientism. And my question at this point is, if during the end times we see this bonding of religion, is not possibly what's going on today a pre-bonding of religion to the global order that's really driving things today? Because it certainly isn't pure, Keynesian economics that we know from the last, you know, 100 years.
Right.
It's something else, right?
Yeah.
I would take my clue from Scripture and saying there's something intensely religious going on behind the scenes that is driving these people to do some of the things that they do. And this is a topic that could just be a blockbuster. Although I don't know if I'd ever sell any books.
You'd sell at least one, because I'd buy it.
Well, okay, I'll make sure to call you.
Well, Pat, that sounds like that will be the topic of our next time that we meet and discuss the issues of the day. And one of the things that we could perhaps talk about next time, too, in addition to what you've identified, is what part does transhumanism play in technocracy? And we'll leave that for the next show, because that's a whole other issue all by itself.
It's a great one, and I'll just say that they're joined at the hip. They need to be explored. It'd be a great topic to discuss in detail. It is way more intensely religious than just technocracy itself, and it is a fascinating topic, absolutely fascinating topic. Yes. So we could develop it for sure.
Good, good. We'll do that, and I'll give our listeners just a teaser and let it go at that. But transhumanism, transhumanism, in my view, is really about man's attempt to escape his own mortality and the penalty of sin. And that's just my take, and I'll leave it at that. And maybe we'll discuss that next time.
I got bad news for him.
That's right. That's right. Well, Pat, I appreciate you being on the show. I've enjoyed this conversation very much, and I know our listeners have as well. So thank you, my friend, and God bless you.
You bet, Mike. Thanks for the opportunity to be together with you.
Amen. Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries, and is released under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives, 4.0 International License. Opening audio montage collection created by Micah 68 Productions. Visit them on the internet at www.mika68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, pastormike@woh.rr.com. God bless you today as you seek Him.